Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we talk to a Milwaukee native and Grammy-nominated music producer who makes beats and music tracks that are heard by millions. First, Toys R Us announced this week that it's closing or possibly selling all 735 of its stores in the U.S. That includes nine here in Wisconsin. A company statement said that about 30,000 people will lose their jobs. Toys R Us began about 70 years ago as a small store in the Washington, D.C. area. It sold various baby items like cribs and strollers. By the 80s and 90s, it became one of the first category killers, meaning it was devoted to and dominated in one thing, toys. But the company lost ground to retailers like Target and then Walmart and then Amazon. And it was saddled with billions of dollars of debt from a buyout. What does this all mean for the toy and retail industries and consumers? Hart Posen is an associate professor of management and human resources at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Business. Hart, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me. Happy to be here.
So before we go back to the history of what happened here, how big a story is it now that Toys R Us is leaving the retail world?
You know, this has been a story that's a long time in coming. I trace back these problems to probably 1998, 1999. And so, you know, there's been a coffin here and a nail and another nail and another nail over almost two decades.
Now, when I think retail store closing, I assume all of the story is something like Amazon and maybe other stores, Target, Walmart. That's part of it. We'll get into that. But as I understand it, there's also a story about a buyout and a lot of debt facing Toys R Us. Can you give us that history?
Yeah, this goes back to 2005 when KKR and other sort of the famous leverage buyout firms did a leverage buyout of Toys R Us, and in the process saddled the firm with billions of dollars in debt. And that a lot of that debt still exists there today in one form or another.
And this was a pivotal time if you're a retail store. This was the time when you're looking at the growing competition, you're looking at the internet, you're wanting to spend your money maybe trying to deal with that. Instead, it sounds like Toys R Us, and maybe they weren't the only ones, they were spending that money they could have been using to overhaul to pay off debt service.
Yes and no in the following sense. The problem started for Toys R Us in 98, 99. It was in 98 or 99 when Walmart became the biggest toy retailer in the U.S. ahead of Toys R Us. So yeah, they were the category killer of the 80s, but by the late 90s, Walmart had overtaken them, and at that time also, you know, it was consistent with the start of internet retail. They had a terrible internet retail experience in the late 90s. They eventually had an alliance, a partnership with Amazon, where Amazon ran Toys R Us's online division. Their own work in that area had been so bad. And so the buyout is in part a consequence of failures that preceded it, even though the debt certainly didn't help along the way.
And Toys R Us wasn't the only one going through this kind of story in the 90s and early 2000s, right? As companies, especially the Walmart of the world, grew, a lot of big retailers, famous names, were saying, what do we do now?
Yeah, and it is undoubtedly true that the Walmarts of the world in the late 90s and early 2000s made competitive life really challenging for lots of retailers in lots of different industries. Some figured out how to compete and survive. Others didn't. And then by the time you add on the shift to online retail in toys, you know, Toys R Us never did survive sort of the Walmart onslaught. The Amazon onslaught was another beating that they didn't survive, and what we see today has been coming for ages.
Was it inevitable from the outset, though? I've seen people say, hey, some retailers have survived and maybe could have survived if they made their store an experience. And Toys R Us, I mean, it's a toy store, right? It's more exciting, I imagine, for a kid to be at a toy store than clicking, you know, on the shopping cart. Or maybe not. I don't know. I'm not
maybe
a kid
not.
Now.
You look young. So an example of a store that survived this is Best Buy, right? So if you go back, there was Best Buy in Circuit City, become really big in the 80s and 90s. Circuit City eventually goes away. Best Buy survives. In part, the interesting thing is the toy makers would have loved Toys R Us to survive. They need Toys R Us. And they would have done anything. In fact, there were rumors last week or last month that they were looking at buying the Canadian division of Toys R Us and using that to buy some of the U.S. stores, because the toy makers, the Mattels of the world, need and want someone selling their toys other than simply Amazon and Walmart.
Why is that? Why do I care if I'm a toy maker if my toy is sold at Toys R Us or Amazon or Walmart?
Bargaining leverage. Imagine that you're a manufacturer of Central Time toys. You'd want more than one customer. If all your customer was one big customer, you could only sell to Walmart or to Amazon, then they'd have tremendous bargaining power. And so that's why the electronic firms want Best Buy to survive. The toy firms really wanted Toys R Us to survive.
Talking to Hart Posen from the UW-Madison School of Businesses, looking at the announcement that Toys R Us is done. They're closing all their stores. They may be trying to sell some of them. We'll see what happens there. Hart, what does this mean for consumers? Because from what you were just saying, maybe if I'm a happy toy shopper, Walmart or Amazon negotiate with the toy manufacturers for a cheaper price, I get to get cheaper stuff. True?
True and not true. True in the following sense. On certain things, the price might be lower, but the trade-off is in the comprehensiveness of the selection. Walmart or Target's toy selection, or Costco is now probably the number six toy retailer in the country. Their toy selection is condensed relative to what Toys R Us had, and it's only larger at the holiday season. So in that sense, the selection can be smaller. That's probably not true of Amazon. But what we lose as consumers, and you alluded to it earlier, is the experience of kids being able to touch and feel things. And maybe that doesn't matter if your child is 10, but it certainly matters if your child is 3 or 4. And I think that's the reason that there is some hope here, particularly for smaller mom-and-pop types of toy retailers. There is real room now to offer a kind of selection that differs and a service level that differs.
Yeah, I've heard that in the book sector, for example, when the Borders and Barnes & Nobles came along, they were putting a lot of small bookstores out of business. When Amazon started putting the Borderses of the world out of business, there was an opportunity for smaller bookstores who had survived that initial problem.
It reminds me of that old movie, You've Got Mail, mm-hmm. right? And the bad guy there was a Barnes & Noble kind of bookstore, and now we think of the Barnes & Noble as sort of the good
quaint,
guy.
Old-fashioned, giant bookstore.
I think there's real opportunity for local and regional toy stores that specialize not in selling the same product that Amazon and Walmart sells, but selling a different selection, offering different kinds of services. I think there's a real opportunity for that.
Now, a lot of people, of course, are losing jobs from Toys R Us and from stores like Sears closing stores, Yonkers, others. There's never a great time to lose a job. Wisconsin's job market, for example, today, not the worst possible time to lose a job.
I mean, look, if you're in Wisconsin, what's the unemployment rate's in the 3% range. In Dane County, it's less than 3%. There's no good time to lose a job, but now certainly not the worst time to lose a job. But I think we also have to keep in mind that this just this happens continuously. The U.S. economy is very effective at putting firms that are poor users of human capital, dollar capital, physical capital out of business, redeploying it to new businesses that can make better use. And this has always been a strength of the U.S. economy, even if it comes with short-term pain.
Are you watching for a short-term pain for other particular retailers right now? What are the next dominoes that you're watching for?
I don't have an easy answer on that. You know, clearly Sears is still going only in one direction, I think. I think all of the mall-based retailers are still struggling and will continue to struggle, particularly the fashion firms, because it's very hard to tell the product of one youthful fashion firm in the mall from those next door. So this isn't done yet.
And then, you know, a Toys R Us closing means there's some pretty big buildings with no occupants right now. What happens there? Do those get snapped up? Do they sit vacant for a long time?
Yeah, I think you might divide the properties that Toys R Us had into those that it owned and those that it didn't own but rather leased. I think it's probably true that some of the stuff they own is some of the older stuff in poorer condition and in weaker areas. I think it can only be seen on a property-by-property basis. And what's happening in malls may have, you know, less to, with the Toys R Us stores that are in better locations, in newer strip centers, I don't think there's one clear answer yet.
Hart, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I'm happy to have been here.
That's Hart Posen, Associate Professor of Management and Human Resources at the UW-Madison School of Business. He joined us to look at the closing of Toys R Us stores, all of them, what it means for the toy and retail industries and consumers. Andre Business Boy Robertson grew up in Milwaukee and learned to make his own beats using a video game. Now he's a Grammy-nominated music producer who creates tracks for top-tier R&B and hip-hop artists. He'll be on the UW-Madison campus today for Black in Business, a masterclass presentation on making it in the music industry. We recently caught up with him to talk about his humble beginnings in Milwaukee and his rise to become a highly sought-out producer in the music industry. Business Boy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
No problem at all.
Can you tell us a little bit about growing up in Milwaukee and figuring out, hey, I want to make music?
Growing up in Milwaukee, it was dope, man. I learned a lot growing up. There wasn't many opportunities like that, but I made a way. I had to make a way, you know. But growing up in Milwaukee, it really taught me a lot. It taught me how to grind because limited opportunities, I'm like, yo, I have to make a way. I have to do something with my life. I have to show the world my talent. So I love the city. Growing up there, I had a lot of support, so that made me go even harder too. I know a lot of musicians come up and they have limited support, but in my case, it wasn't like that, so that made me go even harder too. Just people being in my corner telling me I'm great, people pushing me and just telling me to expand and everything like that. So it was pretty dope, man. I don't have no complaints growing up.
How did you first learn how to make beats and produce music?
It was crazy because my grandma bought me this game called MTV Music Generator for the PlayStation. So I'll just be upstairs just practicing and making beats on this video game. It was crazy. So I'll just be upstairs making all the noise in the world. Like, after a while, I just got used to it. So the game basically was like building blocks, put like a kick, snare, and everything together. And then I think they had like sound samples on there. So yeah, that was good practice. So that's basically how I got my start.
And were there people you were listening to that kind of inspired you or influenced you when you got started making beats and producing more professionally?
I was always inspired by like Teddy Riley. Three 6 Mafia, Bone Thugs and Harmony, Jay-Z. So even in elementary school, I was rapping and I was making my own covers for my albums and stuff. I was writing raps at a young age.
Now, we'll get into making beats a little more in a minute, but I want to ask you about the business side of things, because I think a lot of people go into music, any kind of music, and they're thinking about, you know, performing and recording and not the business side of things and all the work that goes into promotion and marketing and all that stuff. How important was that as part of your career?
Man, I had to learn that early. A lot of people get screwed in the business, you know? So, like, even in, like, high school, I was online, looking up stuff, and just trying to protect myself. I started learning about, like, mechanical royalties, copyrights, and all of that stuff very early, just so I can not only learn the music side, but the business side and protect myself and have a little knowledge. Because the creators, you know, we just focus on creating and becoming better most of the time, but a lot of us, we won't pick up some books or, like, look online and figure out how the business is really ran and how to go about, you know, moving around in the business and how to have proper etiquette and just everything. So I had to learn that very early, like ASCAP, I learned about that early. A lot of people didn't even know about ASCAP. They go out and collect your money and all that, but a lot of people still don't know. And a good friend of mine named Chad, he put me on game early. He was like, yo, sign up for ASCAP as a writer, but also as a publisher too, because you would get double the money. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's smart, you know, because a lot of people only sign up as writers. So if you make your own publishing company, that's like a separate check that you get too.
Well, let's talk about the creative process. You collaborate with a lot of people. When you start creating a song with someone, where do you start? How does the creative process start for you?
Usually I love to get in the studio with the artist. So basically, we always have conversations. I try to see where their mind is at. And then we just start working. So basically, I start with like the sound or like the melody first. And then once the artist approves, loves the sound, and then I go ahead and build around it. So I add like percussion, and I add kicks, drums, snares, hi-hats, all this good stuff. So usually I just start with melodies because working with a lot of artists, especially R&B, it's like less is more with them. So if I start with like keys and like a melody, that's all they really need to get started. And then they can get their melodies out. And once they start singing and stuff to the track, that's when I start adding the drums and everything, the bass. Then usually I'll bounce out whatever idea I got. It might even be finished, you know, but I want the artist or the writer to get their ideas out real quick. I don't want them to lose the vibe. So I bounce the track out, give it to the engineer, and they'll start like singing and getting their ideas out. And then later on, if I need to add stuff to the beat, I'll do that. I do post-production, but I always try to make sure the artist getting their ideas out before they lose that magic. Feel me?
Yeah, so you don't just say, hey, here's the completed track. Start singing at 24 seconds in. Bye.
But sometimes in certain sessions, the artist will want to hear beat first,
mm-hmm.
and then I'll play, like, track back to back, and then most of the times they'll be like, yo, I want that one. You know? And then they'll just, I give it to the engineer, and the engineer load it up, and then they just go in on the beat. So the sessions be different. It just depends on which artist.
I want to give a listen to one of your tracks now that you've worked on. This is with Sway Lee. The song is Hurt to Look. Let's give a listen. All I do is think when I'm away, colors bursting, all I see are shades. Hey. Sun goes away, and that's when I call your name. She's here for good, and I'm here to stay. You shouldn't hurt to look your way. So, Business Boy, talk us through how that one came together.
It was crazy because I made that beat with my homies from London, Forslash and a homie EY. So, basically, started with the chords, and then we kind of make samples. So, when we make samples, we'll start with, like, the sound first, and then we'll do, like, melodies over it. We don't call ourselves singers, but we'll go in on the melodies and record, like, different variations of vocals. So that was next, and then we started with, like, the sounds first, and then we added, like, the drums, and then we sent it over to Sway. Yeah, he loved it. He recorded it. So.
And then we love to see Wisconsin people get recognized, and what was it like for you when you got word that you were nominated for a Grammy for some of your work?
Man, it was super, super, super dope. So I was at the studio with Party Next Door, and we was working crazy hours, probably, like, 9 p.m. to like 11:30 the next day. So probably it had to have been like 4 a.m. And my homie tweeted me, he was like, yo, congrats to my bro, Business Boy, for being Grammy nominated. And the tweet shocked me. So before I got excited, I'm like, yo, I got to figure out what he's talking about before I have any kind of excitement. Like, what am I nominated for? So I text him. He was like, yo, you nominated for the Free Black. And he sent me, like, the link and everything, and it was just crazy. You know, just a kid from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, being nominated for a Grammy. And when we was making the album, we wasn't thinking about any Grammys. We was just trying to make the best music possible. So it was just a shocker, but it's a blessing. I text my grandma ASAP. It's probably like 4 LA time, so it was like 6 Milwaukee time. So I woke her up happy, and the blessing.
And you're coming back to Wisconsin now. You're doing a talk in Madison at the Memorial Union on Black in Business. So what kind of lessons do you have for people, Black people maybe in particular, if they want to be entrepreneurs in the music business or any line of work?
Yeah, I'm excited. I'm excited for this. Really, I'm just excited to give them, like, the real deal, like, give them my whole journey, give them, like, insights on the game, how it's really ran. You know, preparing for the future, how to move around the game, how to network, how to travel, and never stay complacent. And even when things aren't looking up, attack your dreams, because the moment where you feel like quit, that's usually the moment where stuff starts popping off. So you got to keep going and have consistency and persevere and just get through it. And, you know, like, this is not easy. Nothing's going to be easy in life that you really want. You just got to keep going and going until you reach them goals. But that's basically what I'm going to tell them. I'm going to tell them about the music part is easy. So basically, I want to just educate them on all the other stuff that comes with the music business. Yeah, I'm excited.
Business Boy, thanks for joining us, and have a good trip back to Wisconsin.
I appreciate y'all.
That was Andre Business Boy Robertson, a Grammy-nominated music producer, native of Milwaukee. He's on the UW-Madison campus today for a talk called Black in Business, a masterclass presentation on making it in the music industry. We all love spending time with friends and family, but when there's food involved, it can be hard to know what to bring. Our Food Friday guest today tells us what dishes to make that'll look beautiful, taste great, and travel well to potlucks, picnics, and parties. Allie Rosen is the author of Bring It, Tried and True Recipes for Potlucks and Casual Entertaining. She also hosts a food show in New York City called Potluck. Allie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, you point out in your book that potluck sometimes has a bad reputation, and you found that out when you told your mom about your new company called Potluck. What did she have to say?
Yeah, my mom was like, oh, God, people think of potlucks as like sad casserole dishes and like church basements. And, you know, and I was like, no, that's the point. It's like bringing different people together. You know, I was like, I had this whole idea about it. And so, you know, it's kind of been a passion of mine to rethink kind of what we do with potlucks, because everybody likes getting together. Everybody likes people contributing. Everybody now loves cooking and sharing. So I think that we're ready to kind of reinvent the potluck and not be so sad.
And one key part of this, and you get with every recipe in the book, you consider how to bring it. So the portability, the transportation of the food, that is something we want to think about in advance here, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one thing to have a recipe. It's another thing to see how it does if it's like sat out on a table for 2 hours, or if you want to stick it in your fridge for a few hours and then bring it later, or if you stick it in your car and then suddenly you've got like, you know, sauce all over the bottom of your car. Yeah, I know. Sadly, me too. So, I think that, you know, one of the things that I was really testing with this book is, okay, do these items last? You know, can you make them ahead? I mean, the book has 3 different badges that you can find across the recipes. You know, one is, you know, make it ahead. One is serve cold, right? Because, you know, fridge to table, because, you know, oftentimes you don't have an oven, you don't have a place to reheat, you want to make it ahead. And then the other is 30 minutes or less, because no one has enough time. We all want to be able to bring something that looks great, but sometimes we just really don't have a lot of time to do it. So I was trying to think about, like, what are the constraints that people have when they're bringing something to a party? And those 3 kind of stood out to me. So that's really what the focus is.
And one thing that stands out is you don't have a lot of soups and chilies and stews in here. Nothing that requires an extra bowl that people are going to have to balance on their laps or on the picnic blanket or whatever.
Yeah, it pained me because I'm a huge soup person, and I like my freezer is always stocked with soup. But, you know, it just doesn't bring well. It doesn't do well at a party unless you are doing like a soup-specific party. But the book has a lot of dishes that still are warm, you know, but they all can be reheated easily. They all can be eaten easily, cut up easily. And if they can't in a natural way, there's sort of in that how to bring it section, you know, like there's a short ribs recipe where like you can keep the bones in. But if you're going to have it at a party where people are standing, then there's an option to sort of take the bones out. So it's really trying to think through what every party scenario is, because that's the biggest thing with a potluck is thinking it through and kind of planning ahead and saying, okay, like, what are we going to be eating on? How many people are going to be there? Are we going to be standing? Are we going to be sitting? And I think that's where people go wrong, is that they tend to just kind of say, okay, everybody bring something. And then, you know, you get like seven salads and nobody brought dessert.
Yeah, talk about that upfront logistics and division of labor. How managerial do we need to be when we're hosting for a bunch of people?
Yeah, I mean, you still want it to be fun. Like, let's start with that. But, you know, I think the thing is everybody gets afraid of offending people. You know, everybody, you know, you say, okay, bring something, and you don't want to give them direction. But most people want direction. You know, as I was hosting potlucks and kind of talking to people about this book, you know, most people, when you say, oh, just bring anything, that's actually not helpful, you know, and then they just end up bringing wine because they're like, oh, I don't want to like get involved here. So I think the best thing to do is to say, okay, hey, who wants to make the entree? Who wants to make a dessert? Who can make a side? And once you start kind of parsing that out, then you've got a good place to say, okay, where are we? And then do we need, right, like utensils that are specific? Does anyone need extra fridge space? Does anyone need extra oven space? Do we need knives? Do we need serving forks? So I think that, you know, you start with the basics of divvying it out, and then you really have to think through those, like, okay, you know, if people are going to bring entrees and four people need to reheat them and then we're all serving everything at once, like, that's not going to work. So you want to think about oven space. You want to think about the division of dishes. And then you want to think about the timing and whether the dishes that you're making, you know, can sit out, or, you know, if you're outside, can they, you know, hold up to being out in the sun or in the cold? You know, and it doesn't have to be that much planning. Like, I'm making it sound like it's so difficult. But just thinking it through will just make your life easier and make the party better. And if you're the host, then it makes you feel more comfortable.
We're talking to Allie Rosen on Food Friday. She's the author of Bring It, Tried and True Recipes for Potlucks and Casual Entertaining. And Allie, you shared a couple recipes with us. We've got them up at WPR.org/Food Friday or the Ideas Network Facebook page. You mentioned ribs earlier. We've got a recipe from you for roasted watermelon pork ribs. Talk us through that.
Oh, that is one of my favorite recipes because it sounds really complicated, but it's not, which is like my favorite type of recipe.
Yeah, it's like six ingredients, right?
Right. And you tell people like, oh, I've made these watermelon pork ribs, and they think you've been like slaving over the stove for, you know, the entire day. And really, it's just, I mean, you know, people think of watermelon as being sweet, but it actually can be part of a savory dish. And, you know, this recipe is really just about boiling it down, right, and getting it into a thicker consistency. You know, and the flavors there are mostly watermelon and vinegar, and then putting it in the oven. And you're basically just wrapping it up really tight in tinfoil to sort of make sure that none of that escapes. And when it comes out of the oven a few hours later, you have this, like, great sort of thick, jammy sauce that just marries really well with the pork ribs. And what's really good about that recipe is, like, it's great outside served cold, like in a summer picnic. And it's also great this time of year when you want something like warming. So it's kind of one of those versatile recipes that you can bring. You can eat it hot. You can eat it cold. You know, it can sit out and do fine. So those are my favorite types of recipes where it can, like, sound really cool without actually being difficult.
And that reminds me of another sort of basic concept you bring up, reheating food, planning when you're cooking that if you reheat it, you're not overcooking it at that point.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the biggest issue that people have with potlucks and like buffet food in general. You know, if it's sitting out, it's either getting cold, or if you put it, you know, over a flame and then it just kind of overheats, or if you've already cooked it and then you bring it to somebody's home and it gets overcooked. You know, you have to think that stuff through. You know, if you're going to bring something, you know, like those pork ribs or short ribs that we were mentioning, those kind of dishes are great because you can reheat them and they tend to have a lot of wiggle room in the cook time. You know, if you're doing something like a fish, you really don't want to reheat that, you know, so you just want to think through how you store it. You know, don't put the lid back on when it's hot if you have already fully cooked it, because that will just keep heating it. So if you're going to bring a hot dish, you really want to think through the timing of it. But, you know, I keep telling people, like, just bring things at room temperature, you know, like, there's a lot of fish dishes. There's a mustard salmon in the book that's great at room temperature. There's a ginger beef that's great at room temperature. So the idea that all proteins have to be piping hot, you know, it's just not true. If there's a lot of flavor on it, it's okay if it's at room temperature.
We asked our listeners on the Ideas Network Facebook page, what's your favorite dish to bring to a potluck? We have a bunch of answers. Zachary says a six-pack of Warped Speed Scotch Ale. Don't really need a recipe for that. Kristen says a garlic parmesan artichoke dip. Let's talk about dips a little bit, Allie. What kind of dips are a great potluck contribution?
Well, I think things, again, that have a lot of flavor, because if you're bringing something to a potluck, it probably will sit out for a while. So the first people who eat it will get it piping hot. And then, you know, after a little while, it won't be. So, you know, an artichoke dip is great. There's an artichoke dip in the book that is kind of my, like, diatribe against why do we have to put spinach in our artichoke dip? Because really, we just want the artichokes. I have a crab and pimento cheese dip that is always just really surprising and kind of interesting to people. You know, I'm from the South, so there's a lot of Southern influence, but I know you guys in Wisconsin also like your cheese, so I feel like that could be a popular one as well. But I think, yeah, with a dip, you know, you want something, again, that can sit and is exciting enough that if you're not getting it piping hot, people are still going to be happy with it. You know, if it doesn't make you excited when it's at room temperature, then you should probably find something more exciting.
Linda on Facebook says, any rich and gooey dessert. You know, gooey desserts can be tricky, especially at, like, maybe in more of a picnic situation. They can be a little hard to manage. But what are some of your favorite desserts, Allie, to bring to a casual bring-your-own sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, the standard one is cookies, but I think we can get past that. You know, if for something gooey that's also easily portable, one of my favorite recipes in the book is we have these s'mores bars that is basically just creating a graham cracker crust and sprinkling on chocolate chips and mini marshmallows. It's like, it's so easy, and it evokes that ooey gooiness of, you know, s'mores at a campfire, but it's, you know, it's more compact and it's, you know, it can be cut up into bars. So it's really easy to serve, but it kind of has that nostalgic flavor. But yeah, I think that, you know, the main thing with a potluck is, like, you know, you might want to bring your favorite cake that you make, but if it's, you know, if it falls apart, if it's hard to serve, if everybody has to cut it, you know, that makes it a lot more difficult. So you want to try to find, like, single serving desserts that people can grab easily and eat without a lot of trouble.
Allie Rosen is with us on Food Friday. She's the author of Bring It, Tried and True Recipes for Potlucks and Casual Entertaining. You can join in now at 800-642-1234. Do you have a go-to dish that you like to bring to parties, potlucks, picnics? Do you have questions? Do you need some advice from our guest? And has something gone wrong for you in the past? You brought the wrong food. It didn't travel well for one reason or another. You can share that experience too. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or leave a comment and find some recipes on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. We continue our Food Friday conversation with Allie Rosen, author of Bring It, Tried and True Recipes for Potlucks and Casual Entertaining. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is the best dish you've ever had at a potluck? What do you like to bring to potlucks or parties or picnics? What are some things that make a great dinner party? Do you do a good job dividing up the labor, or does everybody bring the potato dish? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post. Get some recipes on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go to a caller now. Ken is on the line in Brookfield. Ken, hi.
Hello. First-time caller, long-time listener.
Welcome.
Sort of. My wife loves to have you guys on, so I peek in from time to time. my mother... It was a great story. One time, I believe we were going to Thanksgiving, and she had a whole pot of baked beans, you know, in a slow cooker in the back seat of the car, and they spill all over the place. So, like any good mom did, she picked them all up, put them back into the crock pot, took them to dinner, and everybody ate them. And they were called forever after that. They were called Monte Carlo beans. And eventually it got out. And it was actually one of those things that followed her. Unfortunately, she died of cancer a few years ago. And we gave out the recipe for the Monte Carlo beans at her funeral. And everybody just...
Aww.
Everybody got a big chuckle out of that. It made the day a little bit easier, you know?
Ken, that is a great memory. Thank you so much for sharing that. I bet that Monte Carlo started to smell again in the spring, too, when it started to warm up. Yeah, and that's the kind of disaster we want to avoid, right, Allie? I mean, I've had those situations of, you know, I've carefully perched the big bowl of something a little sloshy on the way over to the party. I mean, is there a good way to transport something like the beans or something like that to make sure we don't spill them?
Yes. You know, my recommendation, and I actually, like, tested this out a lot. You should have seen me, like, in cars being like, what things hold up the best? But, you know, the trick that I have that actually Chef Michael White from Marea in New York suggested to me is take saran wrap and then take duct tape and wrap it around and then put aluminum foil on top of that. And so you've basically duct taped down your saran wrap and then you've put it on. And then if you have a crock pot or something like that, you can put the top back on that as well. But what it does is it just kind of like holds everything in. The caveat there, of course, is you don't want to do it when it's piping hot. So you want to let your dish completely cool down and then you want to give it kind of that extra layer of protection. But, you know, if you want to do something hot, then my advice is just drive slowly and hope you get a good story out of it if it goes wrong.
I've got this picture of you in doing this cookbook, you know, a stunt driving on a closed track with food in the back seat. Was that part of the research here?
You know, it was a big thing for me because I would ask chefs. Part of my job, you know, hosting the show that I do in New York is I talk to chefs a lot, and I would ask people because, you know, they're always transporting food to events and to catering. So I got a lot of advice. And, you know, when I would go for Thanksgiving with my family or, you know, when we were traveling around and I would be in a car, I would be like, all right, let's see which of these things really works the best. And I've just found that like saran wrap and duct tape, you cannot go wrong. And it's like one extra little step that everybody has in their house. And it just like gives you peace of mind.
Let's bring on another caller now. We've got Mary with us in Eau Claire. Mary, hi.
Hi. I don't necessarily have a favorite recipe, but it goes along with your comments on transporting food. I have a cooler that I use all summer long, as most of us do, for cool things. And then my cousin came to a potluck once with her hot dish in the cooler. We don't think about using the cooler for insulating hot food, but it worked beautifully.
I did that once, and people thought I was a genius. I just kind of stumbled onto that. Is that a pretty good tip? Is that something that you've tried, Allie?
Yeah, I mean, insulating food in general, I mean, something that keeps things cold will keep it hot. So you get some of those insulating bags, and they're good for both occasions. You know, they're great, like, you're going to a beach and you want to keep it, or they're great of, like, I've got a pizza and I want to keep it warm in the bag. You really, with insulation, you just want to make sure that there's layers. And then on top of that, of course, you just want to keep in mind that, you know, not overcooking it piece of it. But yeah, anything that has insulation will keep things cold or hot. And for keeping things cold, if you don't have a cooler, you know, I'm like a huge ice pack fanatic. You can just buy like 20 ice packs and push it around if you don't have it. So it's really just kind of finding that insulated area and then either keeping it hot or warm. And with, you know, hand warmers and stuff, you can use that to keep it hot as well if you don't have a cooler or an insulated bag.
Mary, thanks for the call. We are talking on Food Friday about bringing great foods to potlucks and picnics, things that travel well. Allie Rosen is with us. Her new book is Bring It, Tried and True Recipes for Potlucks and Casual Entertaining. Back to your calls. Lisa is with us in Brookfield. Lisa, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you have for us, Lisa?
Good. Well, I'll just tell you a real easy recipe that I use. We usually go to a summer concert out in the park in Lake Geneva every year with a bunch of other couples. It's really a fun little annual outing for us. And one of the things that I seem to take because it's so darn easy is, Allie, you've probably heard of these, but the little tortellini kebabs.
And
you just put like pre-cooked tortellini, or you can use the tortelloni, which are a little bigger if you want it to be a little more substantial, and just some olives and, you know, marinated artichokes and cherry tomatoes. Just you can kind of, you know, personalize it to whatever you want. And then I just make a bunch of those and they're pretty substantial. You know, you can just pre-cook the tortellini ahead of time and then just thread them all together. You know, there's usually a little bit of dressing on either the olives or the artichokes, so you don't even have to add dressing if you don't want. And then
and they're just on skewers?
Just on like little kebab skewers.
Huh.
And then I just keep them refrigerated. I'll make them maybe the morning of, and even I've made them the night before. And then just take them that night in a little, you know, refrigerated cooler. But honestly, they're fine. When you were talking about foods that are good at room temperature, that's definitely one of those. They're fine. You
Lisa,
know?
Thank you so much. That sounds great. I love that idea, Allie, of using skewers. There's probably a different permutations you could do, too.
Yeah, my mother-in-law used to do what she called Greek salad on a stick, which was kind of a similar idea of, you know, an olive and feta and tomato and a little bit of basil and just kind of putting it on a toothpick. But the tortellini is a great idea because then it's substantial. I mean, I think the issue with bringing food that you don't want to have forks for is always being full enough. So putting pasta on a stick sounds awesome.
Lisa, thanks. We'll go next to, we'll stay in Brookfield. Jim is with us. Jim, hi.
Hello, Allie, I just have a logistic type sign-up comment I'm in charge of, or I run the annual holiday potluck in my office. So it's always early December, and we proudly call it a potluck. But in order to make sure we have an even distribution of dishes and whatnot, I always put a sign-up sheet on a common drive, and it's broken down into sections for main dishes, desserts, utensils, drinks, and whatnot. And I find that works very well. People can see readily what's been signed up for. And, you know, we've been doing this a number of years, and generally people fall into certain categories. But just having a sign-up sheet, either a hard copy outside my office, but now it's all on the common drive, people sign up pretty readily. And it's a nice way to evenly get a wide variety of what you need for a good potluck.
Jim, thanks for that call. You know, in my family, sometimes we'll do the email bouncing around, but that can be tough to keep tabs on. I love the idea of the shared document to sign up on, Allie.
I like, there's a website called Doodle that's good for dates, but it's also good for these kinds of signups as well. There's a lot of apps and different websites that you can use it for now. And I think some of them are great because, yeah, the issue with the back and forth emails and people copy some people, they don't. And the sign up sheet in the office, somebody spills something on it. So, you know, digitally now, it's amazing what you can do with just organizational products.
Jim, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Russ with us in Monroe. Russ, hi.
Hey, how you doing? Great show. One of my favorite dishes and great for a potluck is a paella-type dish, anything with rice and smoked sausage, shrimp. They everybody seems to love them, and they are pretty good at room temperature. You know, they're still flavorful, and they hold up. Shrimp's fully cooked, so there's no real worry there. But I find that to be a very popular dish.
Russ, thanks a lot for that. And, Allie, that reminds me, we've got another recipe you shared with us, deviled eggs with shrimp. You know, deviled eggs I love. I had never thought to put shrimp in them.
Yeah, I feel like Rob just teed me up because we do have a seafood paella and bring it also. So check that out. But the deviled eggs are a version from a dear family friend that I've had for my whole life. And the shrimp in them just adds this like extra layer of amazingness to what's already pretty great. Because, I mean, when you have mayonnaise and eggs, like how can you go wrong? But the other secret ingredient is pickle relish, which is something that kind of people think of as being really old school. And, you know, in these like artisanal times, people don't really use it as much anymore. But it adds this little tang and sweetness. So between the shrimp and the pickle relish, it just kind of makes the deviled eggs, like people eat it and they're like, oh, this is like a heightened version of this thing that I already love. So it's one of my favorites.
So, Allie, you've got all these recipes bouncing around in your head. Are you just always looking for excuses to like have a potluck or go to a potluck or just show up to somebody's house?
Oh, yeah. I'm a cooking fanatic, and I am always... Well, I mean, the problem with writing a book about potlucks is you do get invited over to people's homes with different expectations than previously.
You can't just show up with that six-pack.
Right, exactly. Yeah, when I bring a bottle of wine, people are not happy about it. But, you know, it's such a pleasure because when you bring food to people, there's always a story behind it. There's always an inspiration. Oh, I got this great cookbook, or oh, I was eating at this restaurant and I had this dish. You know, so bringing food really brings people together, and especially when you are with people that you don't know as well, it kind of gives you an entry point to start talking. So I'm always game. I mean, listen, there's a reason why about a third of the recipes are 30 minutes or less. I don't always want to spend all day on it, but I think bringing something is great.
Thanks a lot for joining us today. That's Allie Rosen. Her new book is Bring It, Try It, and True Recipes for Potlucks and Casual Entertaining. Get some recipes on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Yesterday on Central Time, we asked you to share your favorite kind of exercise with us. We heard about geocaching from a guy who's done it all over the world, para-raining from a Wisconsin member of the national team, and some belly dancing, too. And we've heard some more since the show yesterday. AXA emailed, I've been a jazzercise instructor for 9 years ago, but started taking classes as a student when my twins were 3 years old. I loved the me time, she says, and the opportunity to get my muscles in better shape other than just chasing little kids around. AXA loves it because it makes dancing such an integral part of the program. It doesn't feel like exercise. And AXA went on to start ballroom dancing, too, 6 years ago. Both forms of exercise, AXA writes, offer a ton of friendships in the mix, so the social aspect of both are a great form of stress release. So thanks for that story. And on Twitter, a user called One Milwaukee Mom tells us, my kids play hurling with the Milwaukee Hurling Club. It's co-ed and all ages. They have had hurlers in their 60s. All are welcome. She shared a link to the hurling club. It is the national sport of Ireland, I have learned. It's played on a field with a ball and stick. Might be worth a look on a future segment of Central Time. And, Dean, we can start up the Central Time hurling team once we figure out how to play it and the rules and stuff like that. We'll be just as good at that as we would be at any other sport. Bad. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.